National Catholic Register. This is Register Radio, bringing light and clarity to the news and topics that affect your life.
Congratulations, graduates. College graduations are in full swing. How have Catholic college commencement speakers fared? This week on Register Radio, we find out from Patrick Riley of the Cardinal Newman Society. Then we turn to Register reporter Peter Smith to get a window into a business that puts Catholic teaching into action. That and more this week on Register Radio. I'm Jeanette DeMello, editor-in-chief of the National Catholic Register and co-host for Register Radio.
And I'm Matthew Bunsen, Register's senior editor.
This week, we're talking to Patrick Riley of the Cardinal Newman Society. Patrick, thank you so much for being with us to talk about commencement speakers.
Oh, sure. Thank you for having me.
So there's a wide array of speakers. Obviously, every year we go through this, and almost every year we have you on to talk about the who, what, when, where of commencement speakers. But let's start on the good this time.
Good.
Who are some of the best speakers you've seen this graduation season?
Well, you know, we particularly look at a number of the really faithful Catholic colleges that just every year have outstanding speakers. And, you know, we have everything ranging from, you know, the Vatican prefect for doctrine. Cardinal Mueller is at Christendom College.
Mm-hmm.
You know, obviously outstanding choice. Number of bishops have been chosen. Archbishop Lori is down at Belmont Abbey College. Bishop Zubik, the Bishop of Pittsburgh, is at Franciscan University. And then, you know, we just have some outstanding stars who have made such an impact for the church. Ryan Anderson, who I just admire so much,
sure,
the work that he's done at the Heritage Foundation on behalf of the church and all Americans in dealing with marriage issues and gender issues and other things. And it's just been an outstanding advocate. You have Mother Agnes Donovan she's the Superior General of the Sisters of Life. She spoke at Thomas Aquinas College. So, you know, these are just great, great Catholics who are standing up and are just such great examples to our graduates.
Have you gotten a sense of what they're speaking on? Some of these commencements have happened. Several were last weekend around the 12th or the 13th. What are people talking about?
In the case of the really good commencement speakers, you know, they're focused on obviously talking about the future and the excitement for the graduates, and talking about the special, unique aspects of a good, faithful Catholic education, reminding these graduates what they got, which is really something that's just outstanding. And unfortunately, not too many young people are going out into the world with the education that they had. But, you know, Catholic education is focused on formation. It's focused on the development of the whole person. And so you end up getting these real rich insights into how to be as a person and not just how to go out there and succeed at business or deal with politics or, you know, you get the comedians, you know, yucking it up with everybody, which is all fine and good, and that's what many of the commencements are. But, you know, with these really good commencement speakers, a lot of our graduates are walking away with some great advice for life.
Yeah, you're talking about the comedians. That's Jim Gaffigan was at Catholic University of America last year, and there was a positive to that, but there were also some critics of that.
There were, but you know, at least Gaffigan, you know, he brings such a strong message, and there's always an underlying point to everything, you know, even when he's joking or kidding around about something. You know, it's all about the family and the you know, the unity of marriage and children and everything else. And so, you know, all in all, clearly his message is a good one.
Yeah, Patrick, we've been focusing a bit on the most interesting and faithful commencement speakers, and of course, every year there are those who are neither. And I know you had some concerns in the past, certainly in 2009 with the University of Notre Dame, and you seem to have some new concerns for that same venerable school.
Yeah, you know, we have schools every year, it seems, or every other year, that seem to come back and sort of put the thumb in the eye of the bishops and the church, and it's sad that they're doing that. You know, Notre Dame has, at their commencement, they always award, the Lotari Medal, which is an award specifically reserved for exemplary Catholics. And they seem very often to pick people who are just a real problem. This year, it's this Father Greg Boyle, who's a Jesuit, done great work with gangs in Los Angeles, but unfortunately has been very outspoken against the church in terms, in issues of gay marriage and ordination of women and communion issues, and just really not someone that Notre Dame, you know, ought to be highlighting. Out of every Catholic in the United States, this is the one they choose to highlight for the Lotari Medal.
And who are some of the other people who've been invited that probably shouldn't be, from a Catholic standpoint?
Yeah, there are the usual politicians who are bad on abortion issues and marriage issues. You got the Pennsylvania Senator Bob Casey is at Boston College, and Michael Bloomberg, the mayor of New York City, is at Villanova University. Congressman Richmond from Louisiana is at Xavier, and they're all, you know, have real problems with the church. The ones that really bother me are the ones, I mean, certainly those bother me very much, but there are ones that even go the next step, where they're actually deliberately, it seems, honoring people who have had the church in their crosshairs. One of them is this Maria Vullo, who is being honored at the College of Mount St. Vincent in New York. She's the superintendent for New York's Department of Financial Services, and she has been responsible for not only fighting parental notification with regard to abortion, but she has been the point person for the governor in trying to force insurance companies to provide free coverage for contraceptives and certain abortions. And here she's actually being honored at a Catholic school.
Right. Completely contrary to Catholic teaching. It's just amazing.
Yep. Yeah, and then you've got former Congressman Javier Becerra, who's now California's Attorney General. And he's very pro-abortion. Mm-hmm. And he is the person who just recently brought felony charges against David DeLeiden for his videos exposing Planned Parenthood. And even many of the pro-abortion people have said that that was really overstepping the line. And, you know, that in itself, he's allegedly doing his job as Attorney General. But why are we specifically choosing him to honor at the University of San Francisco, a Jesuit institution?
You know, it's really a challenge, I think, for bishops to pull together and actually say something when this happens. Have any done so this year to really call these schools to task?
You know, we have not. I have not seen it yet. Not in a public way. Very often, the bishops will communicate privately. And it may have happened publicly, but I've not seen it.
Yeah, and of course, private is the way it's supposed to happen. But, you know, I want to turn to something before we move on. I have two more questions I really want to get to before the end of our show. And one is that this summer we will be seeing the 50th anniversary of the Land O'Lakes, I guess, treaty mm-hmm. or agreement. And mm-hmm. That was a very important event. Can you just, I guess, tease it? Because we have to talk about this a lot more in a whole show. But tease out what the 50th is.
Yeah, so the Land O'Lakes Statement in 1967, the president at the time of University of Notre Dame gathered together a number of college leaders, and they essentially declared that a Catholic university, in order to be a genuine university, has to be independent of any kind of church influence or control. Mm-hmm. And at the time, they really didn't mean for Catholic colleges to completely separate from the church and to walk away from Catholic teaching. But, of course, we look over the last 50, 60 years, that's exactly what we've seen in many instances.
Yeah, it's so unfortunate. Now back to something more positive.
Sure.
As we close, Patrick, if you could guide commencement speakers on what would be the best thing they could tell, especially Catholic college graduates, what would you encourage commencement speakers to tell these grads?
You know, I just got through reading. Our chaplain for the Cardinal Newman Society is Father Paul Scalia. His dad was the former Supreme Court Justice. And he gave, it was actually a homily, it wasn't the commencement speech, but the homily for the baccalaureate mass out at Thomas Aquinas College. And it was just amazing. It's online if anyone wants to read it. and just really focusing in on, you know, on humility and going forward with a childlike faith and understanding that going out and changing the world is something that God will make happen through them, and that it's not something that they as individuals are supposed to go out and do their own thing. It's you know, so many commencements are so self-absorbed, right? And here was something that was just so refreshingly humble and Catholic and Christian. And I just thought that was just a great message for commencement speakers to send off the graduates with.
And do you know where they could find that speech?
It's on Thomas Aquinas College's website right now.
Excellent. Well, where can we find more about what the Cardinal Newman Society does?
Go to our website. It's cardinalnewmansociety.org, and we have all this information about the commencement speakers, good and bad, and lots of other things going on in Catholic education.
Excellent. Well, Patrick, I want to make sure that our listeners know that you speak almost every year about commencements to Joe Pronishin, who does a sort of roundup of the good, the bad, and the ugly of Catholic college commencement speakers. And this year, that was titled Catholic College Commencement 17, Speakers Faithful or Not, and that can be found at ncregister.com. I did not ask you about Vice President Pence at Notre Dame, but he's going to be there this weekend. And that's a good thing, but it was a little strange. So I invite our readers to go online and take a little bit of time to look at Vice President Pence at Notre Dame. Check out ncregister.com and find our articles about that story. So just a little tease to get our listeners online. Patrick, thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much. It's always great.
When we come back, we're joined by Register reporter Peter Jesserer Smith and his reporting on a business that puts Catholic teaching into practice. This is Register Radio on EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network. More when we return.
Bishop Robert Barron talks about the importance of the National Catholic Register.
You know, the Register delivers something which is extremely important because you won't get it from the mainstream media, namely the Catholic context and perspective. Sometimes the mainstream media will pretend, oh, they don't have a perspective. They're just giving the news neutrally. Well, no one does that. Everyone's got a perspective. What they often bring is a sort of secularist ideology. The National Catholic Register brings a robustly Catholic take on the world, and that's indispensably important.
For a free 6-issue trial of the National Catholic Register, go to ncregister.com and click on the 6 free issue banner, or call 800-421-3230 for your 6 free issues. And as you await your first issue, enjoy our online content.
Let's return to Register Radio on EWTN.
Welcome back. I'm Jeanette DeMello, co-host of Register Radio, along with Matthew Bunton. And we're talking to Register reporter Peter Jesserer Smith. And Peter, you've written a story about a grocery store worth recommending because of its Catholic principles. That's right, a grocery store. So we're talking about Wegmans, and I bet many people don't know what Wegmans is. So first off, let's talk about what is this Wegmans experience.
All right. Well, for anybody who's come from Rochester, New York, I suppose, you know, we'd probably describe this as the beatific vision of supermarkets. But Wegmans is an experience because there's a whole culture in which the customer is valued and affirmed.
Yeah.
The employees are valued and affirmed. People like working there, and people like getting their groceries there. People like the open vegetable market, the bakery nearby, within the store, the cafe area. You know, you can get pizza, you can hang out for coffee.
It doesn't feel like a supermarket. Yeah, it doesn't
feel like a supermarket
at all.
It doesn't. It's really, in many ways, a very social community center where you gather and you shop, and it's a good experience. And
but
one of the things that makes it that way is you're enjoying what you're doing, And you see that people working there also enjoy what they're doing. And it's something you don't really see much in this economy, but that's part of the Wegmans experience.
That's great. That's great. And so where are these Wegmans located? Because I'm living in Birmingham, Alabama, and we do not have a Wegmans.
Well, they began in Rochester, New York, founded by a family called the Wegman family. Although they were really pioneered by a Catholic man, I mean, they were Catholic, but by a man named Robert Wegman, whom we affectionately call Bob Wegman, who took to heart this idea from the Sisters of Mercy that the most important thing in life was getting to heaven. And Bob realized that that applied to business. You had to run your business that way. And that's why they ran this business focusing on quality and treating their employees right and the customer right. So they have thousands of requests to have Wegmans, in various towns. But they've focused on keeping the quality, and they've expanded down to six states, I think. I think their furthest south is in Virginia. So, no, North Carolina. So they are coming. But they're 92 stores, mainly along the Northeast. But they are expanding. But that's why they haven't expanded like everywhere. It's because the family has this vision that really is, in many ways, a Catholic vision for how to run a business.
Sure, and they keep it small. And I've been in one of these in the Washington, D.C. area there in Virginia, and it really is. It's a remarkable store, and just it's a comforting environment. I actually hate grocery shopping, and it's not a bad thing when you're shopping somewhere where you said it's social, and people seem genuinely happy to be there.
One of the things that jumps out at you immediately, aside from this kaleidoscope of colors of the vegetables and the stalls and every possible food type, is just how welcoming the staff is.
Yeah, sure.
And how the store seems to be designed to put you at ease and to make you want to stay longer.
Right, right. You know, and our readers seem to agree, because this story just took off online. That's why I knew I had to talk about it on radio. It had over 6,000 shares. That's not readers. Those are people sharing this story. So that's really a tremendous amount of interest in the Wegmans. So kudos to them. And thanks, Peter, for bringing this up. Of course, you live in Rochester, so this was close to home for you. But you're working on some other interesting stories right now. What is there to speak of?
One of the interesting stories that I'm working on right now actually does kind of relate to this area as well, Saving the Languages of St. Kateri Tekakwitha. And St. Kateri is the first canonized Native American woman for North America. Really, this story is, I'm really looking forward to sharing with readers this story, because it's really been a journey of a process of exploration into what is really the roots of our Catholic Church here in North America. One of the exciting conclusions that I'm really coming to is that we as Catholics really have an opportunity to really rediscover our history and to rediscover a deeper identity by helping Native Americans promote their language. You know, John Paul II had this insight that language is really behind culture. And culture is that essential spiritual link that we need, that God has given us to know and understand him. And that all these different cultures together can help show a different facet of of the divine. In this very fascinating research, I'm uncovering a very exciting story that really lays bare an almost really a forgotten history that I think as Catholics in the 21st century, it would be vital for us to rediscover.
You discovered some very interesting things, Peter, as you began to do your research. I mean, this started off as one story, and then it took twists and turns as you found out more information. Tell us just about one of those twists and one of those turns.
So one of the things that I discovered was that the Jesuits actually were successful in their evangelizing mission of the native peoples. Now, as a Catholic, I really hadn't understood that. I kind of thought Isaac Jogues just died, and so did the Jesuits, and then they got recognized as martyrs some 100 years later. Honestly, what I've discovered is that's half the sentence. The rest was left off. I've discovered, you know, Huron martyrs, I mean, brave warriors for the faith that were recognized as such by St. Isaac Jobs. Hurons who were captured but kept the faith through the power of their language. This is a big theme that comes up, is that the language of the natives contained knowledge in a way that we don't have as Indo-Europeans. Now, and I'll give you an example. You know, we'll say a table, but as I was talking with the professor of Mohawk, they'll say that which holds food, mm-hmm. or something like the knowledge of what that table is contained. It seems like a whole sentence to us in English, but it's one word in Mohawk. And that's how the faith also gets passed down, is spiritual insights are also written into these words because they have a verb-based language. So all these Hurons that had been captured in war or killed or martyred for the faith, when they were brought back and reintegrated into, adopted into Iroquois society, they brought the Catholic faith with them. People like St. Kateri Tekakwitha, she didn't actually renounce her Mohawk heritage. She expressed it not only in her life, but in her death. Mm-hmm. And I'll tell you this, this is a very interesting story. In Iroquoian religion, when a person died, it was thought that their soul would console their relatives and then head on to the village of the dead, the village of the dead souls. When St. Kateri died, in the following weeks, she would appear to her clan mother, to her relatives, to the priest, and she would say, now I'm going to heaven. A Mohawk audience back then would have realized immediately is this is true. She is not only living her culture, but she is pointing us the way through that culture to heaven. And there is just so much stuff. Mohawks became, half of them became very devout Catholics, intense Catholics. There's just so many beautiful stories. I'm just excited to be able to share them.
Yeah, and Peter, one of the things that jumps out at anybody who studies the life of Kateri Tekakwitha or the Mohawk converts to the church is how difficult the road was for them, given the geopolitical realities of the English waging war against the French Empire in North America. So they were essentially exiles from their own Mohawk culture, but still had a very difficult time living away from their fellow Mohawks. And then, of course, we had the loss of the French Empire, so they were persecuted all over again.
So it's very complicated, too, because that's where we need to take a look at the story again, because there was separation because of the religious divides. As some Mohawk became Anglican, and others who had moved further north became Catholic. And so there is this tragedy that happens at times where you have, Mohawk against Mohawk. Although at other times, they would say, well, we're related, so let's let the French and English fight it out because we're not going to harm each other. It gets complicated like that. But there's actually a very interesting church that is in the Six Nations territories that is actually an Anglican ordinariate church.
Hmm.
So in this one little church called Christ the King, where Mohawk is part of the liturgy of Divine Worship, the Missal, you have the Anglican tradition and the Catholic tradition come together in one people. So
I know why you keep doing these stories. This is happening in Rochester, and that's where you are. Wegmans is in Rochester, and so is Kateri mass translation and all of this. But you know what? I think I know why you do these stories. It's because of your love of culture and your love of the Catholic culture and just seeing Catholic culture become really deeply rooted in a people, and whether it's people who are in business or whether it's certain Indian tribes, I have watched you cover these kind of stories. And Peter, I'm truly grateful for it. This is the end of our show, and we can talk a little bit longer about this in our podcast, but I do want to thank you so much for bringing this kind of culture to our readers. I truly appreciate it.
Well, thanks, Jeanette, and I hope readers take a look at the story because I think it can actually help inspire and heal our own church and our own culture if we help them with theirs. And readers will see that when they read the story. It's going to be very powerful.
So was there more you wanted to say? Because we have a few seconds to talk a little bit more about these kind of stories, Peter, and why you do them. I mean, I cut you off on the answer to that, but why do you do these stories?
Well, I do these stories because I really do believe that St. John Paul II was correct, that culture really is our path, is really one of the paths that God has given us to come to know and love him. And the church becomes enculturated so that the gospel of Jesus Christ can shine through a culture and help illuminate its people to understand it. I'm looking at all this. I feel keenly that I'm living in a culture that feels adrift. Like American Catholicism doesn't know where it is or where it's going or what its roots are. I'm starting to read through Rod Dreher's Benedict Option because I figured, well, everybody's talking about it. I should probably do that. And you
me
know,
too.
Yeah.
Dreher has a kind of an insight that we need to be culturally creative.
Right.
But I'm going to see if he gets to this, but the insight that I've had is that we need to reach back into patrimony.
Right.
And patrimony is that language of speaking, of praying with our ancestors, and the culture that they had can help guide us and push us into the future and really gives us a sense of rootedness and our identity. Well, one of the problems in the American church is that I think we lost where our identity came from. And maybe it was because we had a church that became dominated in large part by Irish immigrants and then other immigrants from Western Europe. But our church was originally Native American and French, mm-hmm. in part, and then also English.
Right.
And these are cultural moorings that we kind of forgotten.
Right.
But it was a...
I think you're so right. I mean, there's a great truth in that, and I come from Louisiana. I'm from the New Orleans area, and I have an experience of culture that is quite different, an experience of Catholicism that is quite mm-hmm. different from other experiences of Catholicism that had more Irish roots, if you will. We had the French and the Spanish roots, and mm-hmm. It's a mm-hmm. different kind of Catholicism. So I think you're on to something with this, and I love this kind of reporting. I've been reading Dreher's book as well, The Benedict Option, and I've been wanting to talk more about it with the staff. But I think he does want us to also dig deep and see the roots of cultural roots of Catholicism. That's mm-hmm. why he calls it the Saint Benedict Option, because he draws so much from Benedict. But he may not have the same insights as you're having about American Catholicism, and I think that's a very keen addition that you bring to the conversation.
And we're so unmoored today from even just a generation ago of what are mm-hmm. some of the cultural baselines and foundations that any generation before us would have taken for granted, because we've lost that sort of oral tradition. And we've lost so much of that cultural tie.
Mm-hmm. And Matthew, I think part of what we're experiencing is a self-inflicted wound by the American church in the late 19th century and early 20th century, because the Irish-dominated hierarchy, and they had their good reasons, I know, but they were so concerned about being able to politically compete with the white Anglo-Saxon Protestant elite that they pushed assimilation, assimilation, assimilation. We need uniformity, uniformity, uniformity. I think this is part of the reason why, you know, eventually it leads to 1960s and 70s Catholicism, which ends up bland, mm-hmm. which we don't know what it's about. We don't know what it tastes like. We don't have the flavor of it. Because of this, when we canonize the North American martyrs, we forgot the Huron ones. I'm looking at this and I'm like, well, wait a minute, Jogues and all these people attested to the holiness that they saw, the holiness that awed and inspired them. Why had they been left out? And because they'd been left out, I think it created, in a sense, it reinforced this false idea that they failed.
Sure.
The models failed, whereas actually they were quite successful. And I'll give you the really powerful example I really am looking forward to working into the story involves Joseph, I can't pronounce the name correct, but Chioatena. It was he... This is an amazing story, but he was allegedly on maybe a spirit quest or a vision quest, but he knew that the Creator was going to speak to him, and he was a devout, you know, in a traditional Huron man, And when he heard Jean de Brebeuf speak to him about the Creator's love, he had a vision or an experience of the Holy Spirit speaking out of the mouth of Jean de Brebeuf. And he immediately realized and said, that is it. That is the one the Creator has been pointing me to. And it was this man who became deeply holy. I mean, Jean de Brebeuf attests to this. He was amazed. His wife, Maria Aonetta, I think, became, embraced the faith with as much zeal as her husband. They had celebrated the first nuptial marriage here in the United States, but their holiness as a couple and their zeal for spreading the faith is amazing.
It sounds like there's another story coming.
Well, I think so, because John Paul II, he basically gave him a green light to say, canonize these people, start something. He said they had heroic virtue.
Well, hopefully we'll see that. Peter, we have to end our podcast now, but I'm truly grateful for this extended part of our conversation, and it's great to see where your heart is in the mm-hmm. Catholic culture, and to give people a sense of why you do some of these stories that are off the beaten path, and why they're so important to our faith. Thank you for doing it.
Well, thank you for having me. Appreciate it.
Remember, for more stories about Catholic culture and other Catholic news, check out the National Catholic Register at ncregister.com. Thanks for joining us on Register Radio here on EWTN. For Matthew Bunsen and our producer, Jeff Burson, I'm Jeanette DeMello. Until next week, God bless.
For more information about the National Catholic Register and about Register Radio, go to ncregister.com. Podcasts of Register Radio are posted on ncregister.com and on ewtn.com. Join us next week at this time for Register Radio on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.